6. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins. At the beginning of the 1960s, America believed it had entered a new age. The election of the nation's youngest president, John F. Kennedy, heralded a generational change, one filled with his call for a new frontier for the nation. And yet there was still a 100-year-old stain on the nation from the Civil War. In place of the end of slavery rose the age of segregation and Jim Crow laws across the South. With water fountains, restrooms, hotels, swimming pools, and even courtroom Bibles separated for whites and blacks, the United States was a society of separate but unequal life between white and black Americans. The growing civil rights movement entered the new decade with sit-ins and freedom rides throughout the South, but the leaders of the movement realized national action was needed to fulfill the promise of America. The result would be the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of the landmark pieces of legislation of the 20th century. Signed into law 50 years ago today, the epic struggle to pass the law is chronicled in a book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Its author, Todd Purdom, is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and senior writer at Politico, and he joins us from Washington for the hour. Welcome, Todd, to Charlotte Talks.
Very glad to be with you.
We often associate the Civil Rights Act of 64 with, as you note in the title of your book, two presidents, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson. And the beginnings of the legislation began in 1963 under Kennedy, someone who I think today is looked at as a very liberal president. But at the time, he appeared to be very cautious in advocating for civil rights and really had to be pushed into proposing the legislation. Why was that?
Well, because he had a broader legislative agenda, including a major tax cut that was the centerpiece of his economic program. And to get his agenda through Congress, he was dependent on the cooperation of the Southern bulls in both the House and the Senate, who controlled the committee structure by virtue of their seniority, and they were adamantly opposed to civil rights and to desegregation. So he moved cautiously for fear of alienating them and putting the rest of his program at risk. And it was a delicate dance. He was under a lot of pressure. He'd campaigned in 1960 on a strong civil rights platform. It should be noted that Richard Nixon did too, and the Republican and Democratic platforms of 1960 were virtually identical on the topic of civil rights, something that we tend to forget today. Mm-hmm. But Kennedy, indeed, in the first 2 years in office, moved very cautiously, and in the end, events forced his hand.
Kennedy's vice president was Lyndon Johnson, a Texan who came from the segregated South and who was in both the House and in the Senate, was ultimately majority leader of the U.S. Senate before joining Kennedy on his Democratic ticket in 1960. You quoted his longtime aide, Bill Moyers, as saying that Johnson was, quote, 13 of the most interesting and difficult men I ever met. What was your interpretation of Johnson in terms of both his views coming from the South regarding segregation, but then his transition to civil rights?
Yes, it was a complex situation because he had come of age politically in Texas, which wasn't, you know, quite the old South of magnolias and moonlight, but it was part of, you know, the Southern bloc in Congress. And he had been, by and large, not supportive of civil rights throughout most of his career. By the time 1957 came around and he was the Senate Majority Leader, he did push through the first significant civil rights law since Reconstruction, although in actual practice it was so weak that it was not as effective as it should have been in dealing with the problem. But he was nevertheless the first person to help get it through. What happened was, I think he had a long and gradual evolution on the topic, and it was fueled in part by the fact that he himself had experienced poverty as a young man in Texas, and as a college student to make money for tuition. He had taught at a Mexican-American school in Cotulla, Texas, and he remarked that you never forgot what hatred could do to the eyes of a child. You could see their sense of pain in the daily lives, and he saw them, how they were discriminated against. So as he matured and as his national aspirations grew, he realized that he, as a Southerner particularly, would have to get out in front on this question, or he could never succeed. And when he succeeded to the presidency in the wake of the Kennedy assassination and the tremendous climate of national grief and guilt that surrounded the assassination, Johnson knew that civil rights had to be his first priority if he had any hope of doing the other social justice programs that became the Great Society that he was so determined to pass.
Right.
And so he made it his number one priority. He vowed to fight for the strong bill, stronger even than the one Kennedy had originally proposed. And throughout the late months of 1963 and early 1964, that's just what he did.
Yeah. You also talk about not just the two presidents, but the two parties, particularly those two parties in Congress. And I think you could make the argument that the two parties in the 1960s compared to today are two very different parties from each other. At the time, Democrats had substantial majorities in both the House and the Senate. But some would argue that maybe it wasn't just two parties, that it was actually three parties in Congress. One of the Republicans, but then you had the Democrats split into Southern Democrats and Northern Democrats. How did that dynamic play out in the time of the 1960s in Congress?
Well, it made the passage of this bill possible. And as you point out, the Democrats had huge majorities in both houses, but when it came to civil rights, those majorities were illusory because the Southern Democrats were adamantly opposed to any change. So really what happened was that the pro-civil rights Northern Democrats had to work with the Republicans, including some quite conservative Republicans, to pass this bill in both the House and the Senate. And because the Republican Party in those days still took very seriously its heritage as the party of Lincoln, they were willing to make common cause with the Democrats on this question in a way that strikes us as almost astounding today. We forget that in the end, this bill passed the Senate 73-27 with 27 of 33 Republican votes.
Yeah.
And in the summer of 1964, heading into the presidential election, the Republicans basically removed this as a political issue instead of sticking it to the Democrats and saying, it's your problem, your party's so divided you can't pass this law, why should we bail you out? In fact, they cooperated to pass the bill and essentially to neutralize the single most controversial domestic issue of the day.
And 1964 was certainly going to be an epic political year. I mean, it was a presidential year. You had the death of a sitting president the year before and the vice president becoming the new president. 64 had to be, you know, the beginnings of the tumultuous age of the 1960s that we think about.
Yes, it really was. And one of the sort of poignant things about the passage of this bill is it's not only the sort of greatest legislative achievement of the 20th century, but it's the high watermark and kind of the end of it and the Voting Rights Act the next year marked really the kind of end of consensus on civil, the zenith and the end of consensus on civil rights, which as the 60s went on became a much more contentious issue. And questions like affirmative action, busing, the violence in the streets, ultimately the Vietnam War. By the time of Martin Luther King's death, he and President Johnson, who had been such close allies in passing this bill, were not even on speaking terms anymore.
Right.
And it's a kind of a poignant. The story doesn't end on a triumphant note in a way because of that.
Yeah, leading into 1964, we had certainly the burgeoning civil rights movement. They were conducting the sit-ins, the freedom rides throughout the South. You had the 1963 March on Washington, and then leading into it, it was really the forced admissions to the University of Alabama, and all of these events tended to play out on television. Following the admission of two black students to the University of Alabama, President Kennedy used the power of television to lay out the framework for his call for civil rights. And on June 11th, he argued that blacks should be allowed to use public accommodations to cast their ballots. And he also used a very powerful, I think, technique of comparing a baby born to black parents in comparison to what that child would experience, in comparison to what a child born to white parents would be. And then he went on to say this.
Difficulties over segregation and discrimination exist in every city, in every state of the Union, producing in many cities a rising tide of discontent that threatens the public safety. Nor is this a partisan issue. In a time of domestic crisis, men of goodwill and generosity should be able to unite regardless of party or politics. This is not even a legal or legislative issue alone. It is better to settle these matters in the courts than on the streets, and new laws are needed at every level. But law alone cannot make men see right. We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is, whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free.
A powerful speech. What did that do to begin the debate in Congress about civil rights legislation?
Well, yes, you're right. It is a powerful speech, and I think in some ways it's under-remembered, and President Kennedy mm-hmm. doesn't get the credit for it that he deserves. We think of his great speeches, the Ich bin ein Berliner, his inaugural address,
right.
his American University speech about peace in the world, which he delivered only the day before.
Yep.
And the thing about this speech was he decided to make it at the last minute precisely because the integration of the University of Alabama had been peaceful and there was not violence. And we must remember that one of the students who integrated the university that day was Vivian Malone, whose sister Sharon Malone is Mrs. Eric Holder, the wife of the Attorney General today.
So
we're not very far away from...
Yeah.
But President Kennedy went on the air with a speech that was only partly finished, and some of it, not the passages you just played, but some of it he extemporized at the
right.
end of his speech. And I think what was so clear about it was coming from his heart, and he couched this issue, as he said, a moral issue. He basically framed it in terms of the Golden Rule.
Mm-hmm.
And that set the tone for the whole debate in Congress, which really was played out with tremendous support from interfaith religious groups all around the country who were lobbying their representatives, couching this as the Golden Rule. And it's very hard to fight the Golden Rule,
yeah.
as even the Southern segregationists acknowledge. Richard Russell of Georgia, the leading senator opposed to the bill, said at one point during the debate that we could fight the lawyers, but we can't fight the preachers who have descended on Washington to lobby for this bill. And I think President Kennedy's singular contribution was to frame it so simply and eloquently as a question of basic fundamental fairness, something that was essential to the American dream and the American creed. And of course, as a passionate Cold Warrior concerned with foreign policy and the twilight struggle with the Soviets, he knew that civil rights was giving the United States a giant international black eye, and the Russians were saying, how can you pretend to promote democracy around the world when you can't even really make it real at home?
So it was not only a moral issue, but it was also a broader, almost view of the United States. We were advocating at that time against communism, but we were holding back a segment of our own population.
Yes, and he was saying that's fundamentally unfair. And, you know, as I said earlier, events had forced his hand. The demonstrations in the spring of 1963 on the streets of Birmingham, in which Bull Connor's police dogs and fire hoses knocked children to the ground, tore people's clothing off their backs,
yeah.
it had outraged the world. And it had outraged President Kennedy and had moved him to action. And so what happened was a week after this speech, 9 days after this speech, 8 days, he sent his formal bill to Congress. And it was a sweeping proposal that
okay.
would... extend voting rights protections, it would desegregate public accommodations, lunch counters, and so forth.
We'll get into that. We got to take a short break, but we'll continue our conversation. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's 4th of July Festival, featuring live music from Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers and Mo, plus fireworks on tomorrow and Friday. Details at usnwc.org. Well, coming up tomorrow, a holiday rebroadcast of Charlotte Talks. Baseball came back to Charlotte this spring to a new ballpark in the center of town. After just a few months, the move of the Charlotte Knights from Fort Mill back to town seems to be fulfilling the hopes of many, creating a new vibe uptown and giving the games themselves a major league feel. We'll talk about the history of baseball in Charlotte, go to the park during a game to meet a player, a coach, and the COO. That's all when Charlotte Talks. Tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. We return to this conversation in just a moment. Stay tuned.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, following protests by taxi drivers against ride-sharing services, cities struggle to balance the popularity of new peer-to-peer businesses with existing regulations. Companies like Airbnb, Uber, and Lyft, and the future of the sharing economy.
That's the Diane Rehm Show later this morning at 10 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're speaking with Todd Purdom, the author of An Idea Whose Time Has Come, about the 1964 Civil Rights Act that was signed 50 years ago today on July 2nd. And I'm curious to pick up a thread about the relationship between Kennedy and Johnson when they were in the administration. What was that like, particularly in relation to advancing this idea of civil rights? Kennedy called it a moral issue. Johnson, when he signs the bill, would also kind of define it in moral issues. What was the relationship between the two during their time about this civil rights legislation?
Well, it was a complicated relationship. President Kennedy went out of his way to show respect to President Johnson, Vice President Johnson. He knew that he had been the most powerful man in Washington, the most powerful Democrat as Senate Majority Leader, and he'd traded that for the often humiliating role of the vice presidency. But Johnson had a tremendously fraught relationship with Kennedy's brother, Robert, who was the Attorney General. And there was tremendous mutual distrust, and really, you could only describe it as hatred, I think, at times. And so Johnson himself had been moving very strongly to the corner of civil rights. In the spring of 1963, he made a series of speeches that went well beyond anything the president had said up to that point, before his June 11th speech. And that upset the White House. It felt that he was getting a little too far out on the limb, a bit in the way that Vice President Biden did when he supported gay marriage,
forcing
President Obama's hand. But then President Johnson also tried to give strategic counsel to the administration about what it needed to do to pass an effective bill, and he wanted them to get their ducks in a row to have the rest of the program going first, particularly the tax cut, get that out of the way before the Southern Democrats would hold everything else hostage to civil rights and gum up the works. And he had a long talk with Kennedy speechwriter Ted Sorensen. He tried to get in to see the president. They wouldn't let him. So he told Ted Sorensen, this is what you've got to do. And also, you've got to deploy the president. We've been using a little pop gun, and the president's the cannon, and we need to bring out the cannon. And it turns out, just days later, the president did make that speech. But so Johnson veered between sort of feeling sorry for himself, saying, I'm not competent to advise you, and then having very pointed advice, in fact, about what the administration should do. And the administration did listen to Johnson. And went to do some spade work on the Hill with the legislative leaders, warning them that the bill would be coming, trying to prepare them for it.
It wasn't only that relationship between Johnson and the older Kennedy, but President Kennedy's brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. You wrote in the book that you described the relationship between LBJ and Robert Kennedy, once talked about by a comedian as becoming like brothers, Cain and Abel. What was the relationship between the two men? How did that impact the legislation?
It was very complicated. It went back many years to presidential politics in the 1950s, when Johnson felt that Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, Senator Kennedy's father, was trying to get him to run for president in 1956, but really the implication was that he would fail and pave the way for John F. Kennedy. So there was a lot of mutual distrust going forward there. The effect that it had in terms of the bill was basically this. After Johnson became president, he deferred to Robert Kennedy and the Justice Department aides as to legislative strategy. And he did that for two reasons, I think. One, because he wasn't sure the bill could pass, and if it failed, he didn't want to be solely responsible. And he also wanted to make sure that whatever bill passed had the complete imprimatur of the Kennedy family, because this was seen as John Kennedy's principal, you know, domestic legacy, and that's how Johnson framed it. That's how he vowed to fight for it.
Right.
So he was very careful not to micromanage the process of the bill, to let it be known on Capitol Hill and in the halls of the Justice Department that he was deferring to the Attorney General's strategy, and that whatever the Attorney General wanted, he would support. And Robert Kennedy later told an oral history interviewer that he felt that was partly because Johnson was trying to inoculate himself against any blame if the bill did fail. Mm-hmm. But I think it was also a canny move on Johnson's part because he knew that, first of all, Robert Kennedy had been carrying the ball on Capitol Hill since the bill was proposed. And secondly, he knew that he could not get in the business of micromanaging the bill with his former colleagues because they would resent it.
Right. And that relationship with Johnson and Capitol Hill was critical as well in terms of who on Capitol Hill was really influential. Who would you describe as maybe the top two, three key individuals that really helped to shepherd this very controversial piece of legislation through in a little over a year's time?
Yeah, almost exactly a year's time, as you say. Well, some of them are well-known and remembered today in terms of, history. Senator Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, was absolutely crucial to the bill's passage in the Senate. He and Johnson were old friends. They'd served together in the Senate, Johnson as majority leader, Dirksen as minority leader. They had a kind of a friendly rivalry. Johnson became the first senator to get a car phone on Capitol Hill, and when Dirksen finally got one of his own, he proudly called Johnson, and Johnson said, "Eva, my other line is ringing. I have to call you back." So there was a kind of one-upmanship. A figure in the House who, the minute the Kennedy administration proposed the bill, was crucial is a fellow named William McCulloch from Western Ohio. His hometown of Piqua is represented today by Speaker John Boehner. And McCulloch was almost as conservative as Boehner in many ways, opposed federal aid to education, opposed gun control, and so forth. But he was descended from abolitionists before the Civil War, and he, as a young lawyer right out of Ohio State, had gone to practice law down in Jacksonville, Florida, and was appalled by what he saw as the indignities and injustices of Jim Crow. So when the Kennedy administration proposed the bill, McCulloch made a deal with them. He said, "If you promise to fight for a strong bill all the way through and not water it down in the Senate, as Johnson had done in 57 and 1960, and if you promise to give us Republicans equal credit going into the presidential election, I'll bring along my House Republican colleagues." And that's just what happened.
Yeah. The bill that was introduced was really sweeping in nature in comparison to other civil rights legislations that had been introduced and passed. It ensured that voting registration rules and procedures would be equally applied to all races. It outlawed discrimination in public accommodations, hotels, restaurants, theaters that engaged in interstate commerce, prohibited state and municipal governments from denying access to public facilities, dealt with public education by allowing the Attorney General to file suits, expanded the Civil Rights Commission, denied federal funding to government agencies who discriminated, barred discrimination in employment on the grounds of race, creed, religion, or color, and moved civil rights lawsuits from state courts, especially those in the South, into federal courts. These were all very controversial aspects, particularly to Southern representatives. What was the key thing or the key argument that Southerners in Congress made against this particular piece of legislation?
Well, the Southerners' arguments basically were very much like the arguments made a few years ago about the Affordable Care Act, that this was an invasion of private property rights, a usurpation of the functions of state and local government, a violation of a sort of a man's home and his castle doctrine, and this would pave the way for a sort of creeping communism or a national police force, a big brother system of spying on people. And it would upend decades of settled tradition in the South that kept blacks and whites in separate social and legal spheres. And so they really inveighed mightily against the bill, but the smarter ones among them knew that they were fighting a losing battle, that the cause was really that the country was changing, times were changing, and that the best they could hope to do would be somehow to weaken or delay this bill. In fact, when the Kennedy administration first proposed it, the bill did not have a strong anti-employment discrimination provision. It had a comparatively weak one that would really sort of only cover federal contractors. It didn't have a strong enforcement mechanism. And interestingly enough, that's one of the things that got added as the bill made its way through the House and into the Senate. And for as long as it took to debate the bill and for as much angst as it caused, the filibuster, basically the better part of 3 months debate in the Senate, it did get stronger at every step of the way, stronger than what President Kennedy had proposed in June of 1963. And that also seems, by modern standards, kind of miraculous.
And even though the bill strengthened over time, it was the civil rights movement leaders that really wanted an even more stronger bill at times.
Yes, and that was a tricky part. The civil rights community, by the fall of 1963, was so thrilled to finally have a strong bill pending in the House that they and their liberal allies in Congress made an effort to load it up with a kind of Christmas tree of wish list items that they'd been hoping for years, including, for example, extending the voting rights protections to state and local elections.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very necessary thing, and of course it's what happened just the next year with the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
But in 1963 and 64, that was seen as something that might doom the bill, particularly with conservatives in the Senate. So the counsel of the White House and of the legislative leaders of the effort were for restraint and to, you know, get the foot in the door and get what they could in the first instance and fight for more later. And one of the last political acts President Kennedy really engaged in October 1963 was this sort of delicate dance with the liberals, bringing them back from the brink and arguing that they needed to propose a bill that had a greater chance of passing in the full House and the full Senate. And that's what he did. But it was painful because he had to call the liberal members of the House Judiciary Committee down to the White House, you know, in groups and one by one.
Yeah.
And put the screws to them. And he succeeded, but it was painful because he was in some ways having to argue against a motherhood issue that he was
right.
having to say, look, you know, don't shoot for the moon here.
Right. And when he was also dealing with liberals, he was also dealing with those Southern conservatives who really wanted to load as many poison pills that would ultimately doom the piece of legislation through amendments. There was one amendment that you talked about brought forward by a Virginia representative who was chair of the House Rules Committee, who sought to include one other classification in the protected categories, and that was sex. Why was that a potential poison pill at that time, and what happened to it?
Well, it was a potential poison pill. It was proposed by Judge Howard Smith, as you say, of Virginia, chairman of the Rules Committee. And it was a poison pill because he assumed that his male chauvinist colleagues in Congress would think it was ludicrous to extend these protections, job protections, to women, and that they would vote against the whole bill in revolt. In fact, what happened was that the handful of female members of Congress of both parties rose up and said, this is the least you owe us, and it's very important, and don't you dare take it out. And it paradoxically became one of the most important parts of the law. It became the foundation of modern discrimination law and helped women revolutionize the workplace. We know they're still undercompensated relative to men, but it really opened the floodgates to a whole wave of class action lawsuits that fought sex discrimination in employment. And in fact, when I was making an appearance for this book early on in April, I was at a bookstore in Washington, and a man who'd been a young Justice Department lawyer in this early 60s, the liaison to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the body that would adjudicate these complaints,
mm-hmm.
said that the first flood of complaints they got was not from African Americans, but from women.
Really?
And there was an internal debate in the agency about just how much of the budget should be spent on these sex discrimination complaints, because even then it was seen as a kind of a secondary part of the bill, not the heart of the matter.
Mm-hmm. Many of those Southerners, both in the House but more particularly in the Senate, folks would know their names: Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Richard Russell, who was certainly considered to be the dean of the Senate. He was the master parliamentarian. Here in North Carolina, it was Sam Ervin who was really a key part of that. What was Ervin's role in terms of the debate over civil rights, and how did he approach it? Particularly, you describe a moment of testimony where the Attorney General was going against Senator Ervin.
Yes, Senator Ervin was deployed by the segregationists as their point man on constitutional issues. He was, as we know, a country lawyer by way of Harvard Law School, incredibly smart man, mm-hmm. very well versed in the Constitution. And his designated role in the summer of 1963, particularly as the bill went to hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee, was to torture Robert Kennedy day after day after day, hour after hour, on fine points of constitutional law, and trying to trip him up and trying to ask him what the justification for this law was, trying to get him to admit that the Justice Department had not taken advantage of all the laws already on the books to address these questions. Why did they need a new law? It was such an exhausting process that Ethel Kennedy ran into Sam Irvin one night at a White House party and said, "What have you been doing to Bobby? He came home last night and went straight to bed." And I think that Senator Irvin was, you know, as he later, a decade later in the Watergate hearings, was a colorful, wily character.
Right.
But he was on the, you know, sort of on the opposite side of the debate in 1964. He was on the, he was wearing the, you know, sort of the black hat, if you will,
sure.
in the debate.
Was the debate and the rhetoric as polarizing in terms of language as what we tend to hear today at that time, or was it even worse?
Well, there are ways in which it was worse. I mean, things that were said on the floor of the Senate, there's a lengthy exchange, for example, between Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina and Russell Long of Louisiana over whether it's inhumane to use cattle prods on demonstrators. And Senator Thurmond delivers himself of the opinion that he was chased by one of them once during a fraternity hazing ritual, and it really only tickled.
Yeah.
Senator Long says, well, these were in fact designed for the very sorts of animals that are clogging our streets and refusing to obey the lawful orders of policemen. So we wouldn't think that we'd hear that kind of oratory on the floor of the Senate today. But at the same time, there was a great deal of civility, and senators could fight hammer and tong on the merits of the bill, on the substance of the law, and still treat each other with civility. There's an exchange between Hubert Humphrey, who was the Democrats' floor manager, and Willis Robertson of Virginia. And it ends with Senator Robertson coming over and putting a small Confederate flag pin in Senator Humphrey's lapel and saying, you know, if it weren't for those brave boys from Minnesota and Wisconsin, we could have licked you Yankees, but we couldn't beat them. And they repair to the off the floor for a little evening libation. And I think we don't see those kinds of cross-party friendships and collegiality today.
Yeah. In November of 1963, John Kennedy is assassinated. Then vice president becomes President Johnson, and he views the legislative gridlock in Congress as a way to do what? Is it more of a legacy to his predecessor, or is he trying to build his own legacy with the nation in mourning, the bottleneck of legislation, not just civil rights, but tax and other issues? How did he transition the country from mourning into making it the push for civil rights?
Well, he knew that he could exploit the moment of mourning and guilt to do something about this. So I think it's twofold. He said in his first speech to Congress, no memorial oration could or eulogy could more fittingly honor our martyred president than the swiftest possible passage of this bill. So he knew that that was important. He also knew, as he told his biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin, that if he did not get out in front on civil rights, the liberals in Congress and in the Democratic Party would see him as a old line Texan, a kind of semi-segregationist figure, and he had to get out in front on that, prove his bona fides, so that he could go forward with the rest of the agenda that he so deeply believed in: aid to education, Medicare, Medicaid, all those things that we know now as the Great Society. So it was twofold. I mean, and he was very strategic about it. And in terms of how he went about it, he never wavered in saying that the strongest possible bill had to pass. He was famous, as we know, for wheeling and dealing and making trade-offs and compromises, and he steadfastly refused to make any real compromises on this bill. Senator Dirksen came to the White House at one point seeking what we'd now call a kind of a grand bargain. He was sent packing in under 20 minutes with no deal at all.
Wow.
So Johnson, in every public or private utterance, said we're not budging from the strongest possible bill.
We're talking with Todd Purdom, who has written the book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, about the battle over civil rights in 1964, signed 50 years ago today. We'll talk more after the break about the outside influences into Congress and dealing with the legislation, and then ultimately the success of breaking the Southern filibusters. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Scheel Museum of Natural History, presenting the National Geographic's 50 Greatest Photographs exhibit, featuring renowned, celebrated photos with the stories behind the images. Details at scheelmuseum.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, in the wake of massive protests by taxi drivers over ride-sharing services like Uber, a conversation about the sharing economy and the future of services like Lyft and Airbnb. Diane and her panel of guests discuss that topic at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Back to our conversation here in just a moment on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded public radio, WFAE.
I'm Peter Sagal. Did you know that your old car can support Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? And no, I don't mean it waits until you're inside the house, then turns on the Bluetooth to call the station and donate your money. It can't do that, though it does like to prank order pizza for the Volvo down the block. What I mean is donating your car can help pay for shows like mine. So donate your old car and turn it into the programs you love.
Call 1-866-789-8627
or go to WFAE.org.
And we're back on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're talking about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 with the author of the book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come. Todd, in terms of talking about Congress, it was also very important that there were outside influences trying to negotiate, trying to push the civil rights legislation. In particular, we talked earlier about the religious groups, but also labor unions. Can you talk about how the outside influences may have helped to shape the civil rights legislation?
Yes, well, the labor unions financed a lot of the lobbying for the bill. They helped finance the March on Washington. Their territory was, you know, the Northeast and the industrialized Midwest, where they concentrated on where their membership was. And there were some divisions between the skilled unions and the non-skilled unions as to exactly how strongly they felt about civil rights, with some of the more skilled unions being more skeptical about it. And George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO, was very skeptical about the March on Washington. He closed the headquarters that day, refused to allow his members to participate, was afraid there'd be some unrest or something. But the labor unions were very, very important in terms of paying for the lobbying and helping things go along. But as we said earlier, the strategically interesting case were the churches, and they concentrated their firepower on the Midwest and Great Plains states, where members didn't have large labor union constituencies. They didn't have any black constituencies to speak of.
Right.
They would have no natural reason to be for civil rights, but what the church groups did was frame it in the way that President Kennedy had, as a moral issue, and they deployed bishops and clergymen and rabbis and pastors to call their members and pressure them. They had round-the-clock prayer vigils. They had daily church services. They brought in seminarians for a big conference at Georgetown University. They really pulled out all the stops in a way that they never had before and never quite did again. Mm-hmm. to keep the pressure on this as a overwhelmingly kind of moral issue.
Okay.
And the conservative Republicans ultimately were unable to resist this. And the Southern senators saw this for exactly what it was, which was an effort to, you know, get more votes to cut off debate and to pass the bill in the Senate, and,
yeah,
and it worked.
When Johnson becomes president, you've got all these forces going on, both inside and outside. He was a former Senate Majority Leader. He knew the players. He was very close to Richard Russell, who was kind of the leader of the opposition by the Southerners. How did Johnson play what has commonly been referred to as the Johnson treatment? He would almost get up in your face and kind of poke you in the lapels if he wanted to make sure that something was going to happen his way. How did he operate either within dealing with the members of Congress or just kind of playing from inside the game?
Well, he had to restrain himself in very large measure. And I think one of the things in the myth, the bill is the work of President Johnson's, you know, Johnson treatment,
right,
and his singular understanding of the way the legislature worked. And he certainly was there. He did help round up some votes for cloture in the Senate. He was keeping the pressure on in his public statements. But in contrast to the popular image, he really did not get involved in the day-to-day management of the debate in the Senate, the day-to-day operations of the legislative strategy. And to the contrary, the secret tape recordings he made in the Oval Office show that he was chafing at the strategy that Hubert Humphrey and Majority Leader Mike Mansfield were taking of letting the Southerners talk themselves to death.
Yeah.
He was frantic and frustrated and wanted to put the Senate in round-the-clock sessions and grab lapels and all of that stuff. And he, in the end of the day, he really couldn't do it because he knew it would backfire. So I think he deserves all the credit he gets, but oddly, oddly in a not the way that we think. he deserves credit for restraining himself, and for a person of such enormous ego and drive, that must have taken a tremendous amount of self-control.
Yeah, exactly. Southerners did I think it was an over 80 days of filibustering in terms of trying to get amendments, in terms of trying to weaken the bill. What ultimately broke that Southern strategy of trying to bottleneck it and basically keep it from advancing in terms of ending the debate?
Well, I guess two things. Broadly, it was the sheer duration, the length of the debate. And as it dragged on, surviving aides to Senator Humphrey and Mansfield described to me that it was almost a jujitsu-like process in which the fundamental energy of the equation shifted. And it was the Southerners who were on the defensive about trying to justify and explain why they'd tied up the Senate and tied up the business of the country for week after week. And suddenly the civil rights forces had the upper hand, and they looked, because they had let the Southerners have their say and have their day, and because they had not railroaded the debate or rammed things through, it was obvious to the most casual observer that the pro-civil rights forces were behaving in an extraordinarily fair way, and that put pressure on the segregationists. In the technical sense, what happened was that Senator Dirksen, whose own home state of Illinois already had strong anti-discrimination laws on the books, it had a strong public accommodations law, and it had a strong employment discrimination law, he arranged for a compromise that states like his could get first crack at enforcement before the Fed stepped in, because he didn't want, as he saw it, to have a dual record-keeping system that would burden the small businessman. He thought it would be better to let the state and local agencies take precedence if they had laws on the books before the federal government would step in. And so that compromise had the effect of bringing along some of his fellow Midwestern conservatives, just enough of them. Because remember, there were 18 Southern Democrats who were just totally opposed to this bill, which meant that there were really something less than 50 Democrats who were for it.
Right.
That meant they had to get on the order of two dozen Republicans or more, because in those days it took 67 votes to cut off debate and impose cloture. And so that's what happened. Senator Dirksen's compromises made the bill palatable to just enough Midwestern and Western Republicans that they came along. And the Southerners saw that again. They saw it exactly for what it was, as a strategy to round up more votes for cloture. And it had the effect of targeting the bill principally on the Southern states, the states of the old Confederacy, where segregation was legal, and leaving untouched the de facto segregation that endures in places like Boston or Chicago or, you know, Washington, D.C.
Right.
to this day.
Right. You talked about the fact that Republicans and Democrats, it was a truly bipartisan. When they finally had the votes, I believe in the House, 80% of the Republicans voted for it, whereas only 61% of Democrats in the House voted for it. In the Senate, it was 82% of the Republicans voting for it to 69% of the Democrats. That had to be a tremendous victory for Johnson to go out and say, this is true bipartisanship.
Yes, it was. And Senator Richard Russell of Georgia said on the day that the cloture vote occurred in the Senate and it was clear the bill would pass, the person who walked him back to his office was the chief lobbyist for the NAACP, Clarence Mitchell. And he said, you know, Clarence, because Senator Humphrey conducted this debate on such a high plane and let us have our say, we now can go home to our constituents and say, we lost fair and square.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Russell stepped up and said, this bill is the law of the land, and as long as it's the law of the land, we have to obey it. And that stands in very stark contrast to what happened with the Affordable Care Act, which, as we know, was passed on such a narrow partisan basis and is still being hotly resisted in many quarters today.
Sure. When Johnson finally signs the bill, he addresses the nation before doing so, and like Kennedy, framed the legislation in his speech as part of our nation's founding on freedom and equality. And he says this:
Americans of every race and color have died in battle to protect our freedom. Americans of every race and color have worked to build a nation of widening opportunities. Now, our generation of Americans has been called on to continue the unending search for justice within our own borders. We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment. We believe that all men have certain unalienable rights, yet many Americans do not enjoy those rights. We believe that all men are entitled to the blessings of liberty, yet millions are being deprived of those blessings, not because of their own failures, but because of the color of their skin. The reasons are deeply embedded in history and tradition and the nature of man. We can understand without rancor or hatred how this all happened, but it cannot continue. Our Constitution, the foundation of our republic, forbids it. The principles of our freedom forbid it. Morality forbids it. And the law I will sign tonight forbids it.
How important was Johnson's framing, again, in terms of morality and the values of the American founding, in terms of presenting this finalized piece of legislation to the country?
I think it was very important because, he described it as the natural fulfillment and the natural extension. He cited those phrases from the Declaration of Independence as the natural fulfillment of our founding creed. And he signed it on July 2nd, practically the eve of the 4th of July. It was a very appropriate way to frame the law, I think. And he described it, as you just heard, in a kind of minimalist way, saying this is basic fairness. And it was a revolutionary law, after all, but he didn't want to say, I'm signing a revolutionary law that's going to upend decades of settled practice in our country. He was trying to say, from the other perspective, this is only natural, and it's perfectly normal, and it's the logical extension of what we set out to do as a country years ago. And I think that was a very canny way to do it. Later that weekend, after he'd signed the law, he was talking with his old friend, Governor John Connally of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He urged him to talk about urging people to obey the law, not enforcing the law.
Right.
And he said, enforcing it sounds upsetting, but obeying sounds like the right thing to do.
Before the legislation was signed and finally enacted, both Kennedy and Johnson talked about the potential political ramifications of this kind of legislation. Kennedy was quoted as saying he doubted if they brought about civil rights, he doubted that Democrats could carry no more than two or three Southern states in 1964 when he thought about running. Johnson was told by Richard Russell that if he got legislation, Johnson might not only lose the election in 64, but he would lose the South forever. And Johnson later was quoted as saying, we have lost the South because I've signed this piece of legislation. What it was the political or is the political legacy of this particular act?
Well, we're seeing it today. I mean, Johnson was right. The trend toward republicanism in the South was already underway in suburban areas, in the rings outside Atlanta and other modern southern cities where the middle class was rising. But this really did exacerbate and accelerate the flipping of the party, so that today we still have Southern Democrats, they're just Republicans. And it's actually part of why the celebration of the anniversary of this bill in Washington has been a little bit fraught. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party wants to and ought to be able to take credit for its role in passing the bill, but of course the Republican Party of today is a very different creature. And the nature of partisanship in Washington today is very different. John Boehner, even as he commemorated the anniversary of the signing of the bill, is in the process of filing a lawsuit against President Obama for failing to execute the laws. So the climate that allowed for this bill to be passed seems like only a dream remembered. And it's hard to believe, really, that 50 years ago, the level of bipartisanship that produced this bill ever existed at all.
Yeah. In writing this book, you're dealing with a lot of what I would call larger-than-life characters. Who did you find as the most interesting personality or character in this very monumental time?
Well, it's hard to not be overawed by President Johnson, who was a titanic figure. President Kennedy himself, of course, I think he rightly is criticized for his hesitation on civil rights, but when he jumped in with both feet. Personally, it's impossible to resist Everett Dirksen, who was just an incredibly colorful character, a master orator known as the Wizard of Ooze. He had this rolling voice, which he kept lubricated by gargling every day with Pond's cold cream and water and swallowing it. He kept a private office at the back of his suite called the Twilight Lodge, and it had a fully stocked bar and a clock on the wall, and every hour on the clock was five, so it was always perfectly appropriate time for a drink. And it's quite clear that a lot of the final negotiations on the bill did take place with the aid of distilled spirits, and I think that that too was a very different time.
I wonder if a modern Twilight Room would come in handy for some of the legislation we're dealing with.
I certainly have to wonder if it couldn't hurt. You know, it couldn't hurt. It's like chicken soup. Might try it. You know?
What surprised you the most in terms of passing and doing the research on the passage of this important piece of legislation?
Well, as I think I said earlier, I had not really understood the extent of the interfaith lobbying effort. I don't think I really – we remember, of course, Dr. King and the brave demonstrations and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and all that. We don't remember the sort of quieter – More behind-the-scenes lobbying by the church groups, and I think that was a revelation to me. Also, while I knew it was bipartisan, I grew up in Illinois, I knew of Senator Dirksen, I didn't understand just how overwhelmingly bipartisan it was, or how the Republicans, as I said, acted really against their narrow partisan interests. Their partisan interests would have dictated that they make a stink about this and keep it alive as an issue and deprive the Democrats of the ability to pass it. Instead, they conspired with them to pass it, and you know, that's all the more remarkable.
Yeah,
all the more remarkable.
The bipartisanship is something we certainly don't see today. It would be amazing to see if this kind of legislation would ever pass again. This has been a fascinating conversation. The book is An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Todd Purdom of Vanity Fair and Politico, thank you so much for the hour.
Thank you so much.